9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring today. Robert Half is here to help. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
Are you a plutocrat with tens of millions lying around? Well, you're going to want to listen to our next podcast coming up from Wall Street Journal Real Estate. It's the Candaces. Candace Taylor, Candace Jackson, talking about American real estate.
You're listening to Free for All from the Wall Street Journal. Now, here's Jason Gay.
Hi, this is Jason Gay of the Free for All. And oftentimes on this podcast, we talk about sports. We talk about football. We talk about baseball. We talk about NBA, college, and beyond. But today I want to talk about America's most popular sport, and that is talking about real estate. And if you're a Wall Street Journal subscriber or loyalist, or you steal your neighbors, like that guy in Berkeley was doing apparently, you know that the Wall Street Journal has some, well, kick-ass real estate coverage. There's daily coverage, and then there's this crazy section called Mansion, which, when I first heard about it, I didn't know what to think about the whole thing, but I have to tell you, it is the most addictive section in newspapers today. It's always Fridays, and it is just, if you've ever wanted to see what the world of the super fabulously wealthy, and maybe you are one of them, and if you are, congratulations, it's an incredible portal into a real estate world that you just don't see very often. And two of the people who bring us into that world are named Candace. I don't know if this was a edict from the top, and they can clue us in, but Candace Taylor, who's here in the studio, and Candace Jackson, who is joining us from the Wall Street Journal headquarters in San Francisco, are two spectacular reporters who cover different aspects of the industry, and I'm thrilled to have them both here today. So, Candace Taylor, hello.
Hello.
And Candace Jackson in San Francisco.
Hi, Jason.
How's the weather in San Francisco today?
You know, rainy and overcast, typical thing.
Hell with you guys. It's 20 degrees here.
60.
Now, I'm going to get personal right off the bat here and ask you both about your current living arrangements. Do you live in a mansion, Candace Taylor?
I most certainly do not.
Now, do you live in an apartment here in New York City?
So I live in an apartment in Park Slope.
Okay.
I rent. Candace J is a homeowner.
You are a homeowner,
so you might
Candace
want to start
J.
with her. But I think it's funny that, so Candace J and I in many ways have similar lives.
How so?
She actually used to live in Brooklyn back when she was here in New York.
Okay.
Now she's in San Francisco. So for a while, it was kind of like we were the same person a little bit.
Now, Candace J, are you a recent homeowner or has this been...
Yeah, I just bought a home that I remodeled, and it does feel like a mansion to me because I've always lived in a tiny apartment, but it's probably not a mansion by mansion standards.
I just went through this myself. It is a window into a experience. I mean, there's nothing like actually having to go through it yourself to make you appreciate what everyone's been complaining to you for years
exactly.
about, right? Did you enjoy it or did it nearly crush you?
I enjoyed it, actually, but it was definitely full of a lot. It was like a second little job, you know, so it was time consuming. But I mostly enjoyed it.
Now, Candace J, what did you cover before you started getting into the real estate world?
So I've been covering real estate for probably 4 or 5 years. And before that, I wrote about art for the Wall Street Journal. And then prior to that, I wrote about travel. So they've always been, you know, real hardship assignments, basically.
Nothing on the front of the war yet.
No. No.
And Candace T?
So I've been covering real estate since 2008. I started covering it right before the bubble burst.
Okay.
So that was...
So you caused the bubble to burst.
Pretty much, yeah. Me coming on board. So it's actually been pretty interesting. Before I was at the Journal, I was at a real estate magazine called The Real Deal.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And before that, at the New York Sun.
Oh, yeah, right. So, well, you certainly know New York City real estate. And I'll start with that. I think I saw recently that the average price now, the average listing for a private home in New York City has eclipsed or is very close to $2 million?
I don't know.
In Manhattan?
In Manhattan, I think it's close to $1 million. Or listing price.
Listing price.
Yeah. Yes, that would make sense.
Yeah.
And as a resident of New York, it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. Now, you know, I want to talk about bubbles and whether or not you guys believe they exist. But, you know, why is it that New York just retains such value and didn't really kind of slip in a way that the rest of the country did?
Well, we have a very limited amount of space here, especially Manhattan is literally an island. So we have very low vacancy rates, and that's a big part of it. But another part of it is just plain speculation.
Yeah.
I mean, people just believe in the value of New York real estate, and they keep buying even when values are wildly overpriced, which I think they are right now.
You do, yeah.
Absolutely.
New York, too, is that a lot of the market has been co-ops, you know.
Yes.
I mean, a lot of the new stuff we hear about now is condo buildings.
Yes.
But co-ops typically didn't have people in mortgages they couldn't afford because there's so much scrutiny on, you know, your finances to even get into the building. So that was a little bit of a little bit helped the market as well.
I bought a co-op with my wife, and the other people in that building now know more about me than my wife does. The amount
of
scrutiny.
Really have to open the kimono on a co-op.
There wasn't much behind the kimono, but they saw it all. But what about the thing that you always read about with some of these spectacularly priced listings that, you know, New York has become home to, you know, an increasing number of oligarchs who are purchasing, you know, oftentimes, you know, 8-figure, 9-figure homes as a way not necessarily to create a permanent residence, or a primary residence, rather, but as a way to park money. And how big a phenomenon is that?
I mean, that's huge. Certainly a lot of what I write about, a lot of the homes I write about are 20 million and up.
Yeah.
And so much of that, I feel like, is driven at trying to get those buyers from overseas who are just looking to put their money someplace safe. And so I think it's really interesting. This morning, the Treasury Department, I don't know if you saw it, they announced they're going to start keeping track, actually, of who the individuals are.
Yes, no more secret corporations and LLCs.
Yeah, that's
going to
be
like
very
that.
Interesting. I think that's huge.
Although I'm sure they'll find a way to get around it.
Will that dissuade buyers?
I think it will. Well, it's only in 2 cities, right? It's going to be in New York and Miami, New York State and Florida. I'm not sure if it was city or statewide, but I don't know if it'll dissuade buyers, if it'll move them to different or cause them to look at different markets, because right now the way these international buyers are buying is a very sort of international way. They're just looking for something in the U.S., and they could be comparing New York to Miami to L.A. to Aspen. So that could sort of shift the buyers, or, like Candace T. said, they might just find ways around it with clever accounting and things like that.
Now, Candace J., you're in the Bay Area, which I hear is very affordable these days. I mean, it's just, you know, one of the easiest places to find an apartment in America.
Yeah.
It really might be harder than New York City. I mean, we're talking about how ridiculous New York has gotten, San Francisco and Marin County are equally preposterous. Is that fair to say?
I think that's very fair to say. I mean, just my own personal experience, I'd owned a place in New York, a co-op. It was, you know, we had to put in maybe 2 offers before we bought it. This was back in 2005. And now I bought a place here. I put in, I think, 9 or 10 offers before I got the house that I ended up in. It's just, and every offer was a bidding war. I mean, it's
and oftentimes competing against all cash, I imagine.
Yeah, oftentimes bidding against all cash a lot of the time, and it's typically at least 20% to 50% over the asking price is very common in prime neighborhoods.
And what about the phenomenon we've seen even in New York that, you know, I always imagine when you are getting investors buying property that, you know, they were looking at buildings, they were looking at, you know, large structures, and they weren't, you know, interested in buying 1, 2, 3-bedroom apartments. But in fact, that is what's happening in New York City now. And you are competing. Forget about the all-cash buyers who intend to move there with their families. You're also competing against, you know, consortiums, investment groups that are going in and buying housing stock for that reason, too. Is that happening there as well?
Yeah, it is. I mean, here it's not as big of a phenomenon as New York, but it is. And where it's happening that sort of is a little bit surprising is in Silicon Valley, which is very suburban.
Yeah.
They're getting a lot of Chinese buyers that are buying whole houses. They typically want new construction or something that's just been remodeled, but it's a huge part of the market there, and prices have, I think, more than doubled in the last 4 years down there, average prices. So it's, it's having a big impact. I mean, the other thing in the Bay Area is, unlike New York, they just don't build maybe enough new housing,
yeah.
Or there's a lot of hurdles to building anything new. So in New York, you see this huge condo boom happening kind of in response to this demand. San Francisco, you see like a little bit of a boom happening, but there's not as many new, things being built as you'd think. So just driving up the prices on everything that's already here.
A question for both of you, because you write about these things and you get to see them firsthand, I imagine, once in a while. I remember when I first moved to New York, I was like, okay, I know what an $800 studio looks like, and I know what a $1,200 studio looks like. Do you now have, in your head, what a $25 million home looks like? I mean, do you have, you're like, well, this, can you deduct,
yeah.
can you interpret value in a way that you never imagined you would be able to?
Sadly, yes, right? I feel like, yeah, it's kind of a strange thing when you start looking for real estate on your own, and the houses I look at for work are sort of in a different stratosphere, but
less than 25 yeah. million is what you're saying.
Yeah, way less than 25 okay. million, yes, many multiples less, but it's very different in every market. I mean, and it's crazy in some markets that $20 million can always get you a great house, but in many markets it doesn't get you the best house anymore.
Is that true in New York City, Candace?
Well, in New York City, it might not even get you outdoor space.
$20 million won't get you outdoor
crazy.
Space necessarily?
I was just looking at a floor plan this morning. I can't remember where it is. Oh, $14 million. The Donald Trump.
Okay, there's a Trump apartment.
Donald
in
Trump
the paper
just sold
today.
His apartment.
Okay.
One of his many apartments that he owns in the city. It's
okay.
one of the penthouses he owns on Park Avenue. Sold it for $14 million.
Okay.
It's a lovely apartment.
This was not his primary residence.
No. He has never lived there. This is one of the he developed the building. This
okay.
is one
yeah.
of the units that he retained from developing the building.
Okay.
27th floor, great views from up there.
Furnished?
I don't know if it's furnished, actually. But no outdoor space.
No outdoor space.
No terrace.
Yeah.
So.
Do they think they're getting a couple extra mil because it's Donald's name on it?
They wouldn't answer that question.
Okay.
I tried to trap Ivanka on that, and
yeah.
she just wouldn't be nailed down.
A couple months ago, I had the opportunity for some super random reason to visit the, I don't know, what do you call it, the penthouse at the Pierre Hotel, which I believe is on the market for what now, roughly? It was on the market for $100 million, I think.
Yeah, and then it was on for $95.
Slashed!
I think it sold.
It sold?
I think so, but
Yowza.
I don't remember what it sold for.
But I,
that one has outdoor space. That
it,
is
it
nice
does
terraces.
Have outdoor space, and it has these, what are they, parapets or whatever, like sort of off the four corners of this penthouse. And yet you walk in it, and you sort of feel like you're at a Marriott convention center. I mean, it's so massive, and the spaces are so huge. They're so impersonal. I mean, this is not to say a great decorator couldn't go in there and make it, feel personal. But they, at a certain point, it very much stopped feeling like an apartment and felt like a function hall. Is
yeah,
that
I think that's
common
like
for that kind
with-
of thing?
That is a problem I'd love to have, Jason.
Yeah, okay.
But it is sort of something I notice with a lot of these houses, too. The other thing I think is interesting to me is when you buy like a $20, $60, $100 million house, the house has so much space, you can't really ever be alone in it. There has to be somebody
yeah.
constantly helping
sure.
you keep the space up.
Yeah.
You have a staff. You've got full-time cleaners who probably live there and a cook. So there's even though you have all this space, you're never alone. It's sort of this strange thing.
All right, here's a mansion-y question for both of you, which is that, you've seen what a 10,000-square-foot home is like, and as you said, there's a multitude of reasons why you need a lot of people working. So what is, if you had your druthers, an open checkbook, what is the, in your estimation, you say you have, average-sized family, what's the proper size? What's a good size for a home?
Oh, gosh. Candace J., I'll have to let you take this.
For like a family of four, you're saying?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, I would say like 2,000 square feet is probably a great-sized house and very,
Wait a second. That's like a walk-in closet in some of these places.
I've seen closets larger than that, actually.
Really?
But
oh,
I think, yeah, maybe 2,500 square feet would be a good sized home, 2,000 square feet, I think would be very doable. And many people live, obviously, in much smaller places.
Sure.
But yeah, you don't necessarily need that much space. Now, it kind of depends on your lifestyle. A lot of people buying these houses are used to certain amenities. If you want to start adding like a bowling alley and an indoor pool and a shooting range and all that,
that all sounds great.
Clicks up pretty quickly.
Now what, Candace Taylor, what in your estimation from what you've seen from little, you know, accoutrements, what's worth it? What's like, gosh, you know what? It's crazy, but I would totally do that if I could.
Well, that is a fun game that we like to play at Mansion. But one thing that, and it's very personal, obviously. Everyone's different.
Sure.
One thing that I always come back to is waterfront.
Okay.
If there's anything that's worth it to me, it's beachfront property.
Yes.
And, of course, not all beachfront property is created equal.
Right.
But some of those spreads out in the Hamptons, like in Southampton, right on the ocean.
Yeah.
Some of those are beautiful.
I'm always struck in the times that I've been out in the Hamptons, and it's only by invite, not as a homeowner, but that you see these gazillion-dollar mansions that are built on the beach, and yet they're so close to each other, you could hear your neighbor sneezing or flushing the toilet. It's crazy how they just stack them right next to each other.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is crazy. I disagree with you, though, Candace Taylor. I feel like beachfront is awesome, but even some of these huge Hampton homes, you have, like, people right in front of your house because you're on the beach.
The riffraff.
That private, you know? Yeah, the riffraff. I mean,
So what to you would be the ultimate perk if you could just get it?
I think maybe like a mountainside, private seeming ski in, ski out location.
You want snowy isolation.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, I'm a beach person. I just want to lounge on the beach. But to your point, Candace J, I don't know if I'd want to do like Miami for that reason.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of these condo buildings down there, they have a whole beach club and pool all to themselves, and I'd rather have sort of my own private beach.
All right.
Well, the other thing as far as like an indoor amenity that I really like and I would have if I had this money would be a private movie theater that played first-run movies. That's becoming very common.
What do you mean, like, plays first-run movies? That's the hard part, right? How do you get the first-run movies?
Yeah, there's a system now you can buy. It's thousands of dollars or maybe tens of thousands.
Way.
And then for like a couple hundred dollars, you can get whatever movie is opening that weekend on your private home theater.
So you have to buy the service, and then you have to pay additional hundreds to get it?
Yes.
So this is like, so you're just a super, super plutocrat, and you build this home movie theater, you should subscribe to the service, and you can have Star Wars at your house opening weekend.
Yeah,
maybe not Star
Wars.
But
you could have a big group of people over, so I don't know, the cost might start to make more sense.
You start spreading it around 500 ahead. This is amazing. I did not know about that. We're going to come right back after this break and talk some more about the lifestyles of the Candaces.
AI may be the most important new computer technology ever, but AI needs a lot of processing speed, and that gets expensive fast. Upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is the single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. Do more and spend less, like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic. Take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/wallstreet. Oracle.com/wallstreet.
Hi, this is Kevin Sintemong.
This is Beth Cracklauer.
Check us out on the Off Duty podcast. We talk about food,
cocktails,
cars,
tech,
watches, fashion,
travel,
all of the finer things in life.
Check us out at wsj.com/podcast
and become a subscriber on iTunes.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously. Now, here's Jason Gay.
We're back talking luxury real estate with the real estate Candaces of the Wall Street Journal, Candace Taylor and Candace Jackson. Candace Jackson, I am still obsessed with this first run movie theater. I had no idea this thing existed.
Well,
what did I miss? Was there a story? Am I embarrassed? Should I be humiliated that I didn't see this story?
No, it's something that's just becoming common. The other thing that might kind of blow your mind is the in-home IMAX theaters, which are, Candace Taylor probably has noticed, in a lot of new houses as well. It's a private IMAX theater in your home, but you have to have so much space to accommodate the proportions of an IMAX screen that, you know, you have to have like a pretty much a movie theater-sized theater in your house to do it. But this is the new thing.
Now, I have a friend who has something like this, who has not a first-run movie theater, but created a home theater in her home. And I watched all I wanted to do as a sports writer is I wanted to watch basketball. So I had her turn on the NBA Finals, and it was so crazy. It was almost overwhelming just how massive the experience was. That I just, you know, I don't know if I could handle. You know, I'm so ADD and distracted watching sports anyway. The idea that I could actually focus on it like a movie, like cinema, I just don't think I could do it. I'd be down there like flipping around, like, you know, 500 channels, like, oh, I wonder what's on the E right now. Okay, so I want to talk about a big property that Candace Taylor wrote about earlier this week. The Playboy Mansion is on the market for $200 million.
You can pay $200 million and not live in the Playboy Mansion.
And not live in the Playboy Mansion because there's a stipulation in there that says that Hugh Hefner, the founder of Playboy, has to stay there as long as he likes. And he's 89, so, you know, looks to be in strong health and obviously has had vigorous exercise late into life. $200 million, where does that put it in the index of private home listings in the U.S. right now?
Well, I think there's a couple other $200 million ones out there, right, Candace J., or about to come on the market?
There's a couple others. It's definitely towards or very close to the top, but I think there's one in Florida and maybe one in L.A., and there's a handful, which used to be an unheard-of price just a couple of years ago.
And forgive me for not knowing, it's a Tudor mansion.
Yes.
And it was not built for Hefner.
No, it was built in 1927,
right.
So it's actually
so it's a
historic.
Classic Hollywood Tudor.
Yes.
Or Holmby Hills, correct? It's the sort of suburb of Beverly Hills.
Yeah, and it was, so it's this historic place. He renovated when he moved in. He built the whole grotto and pool and everything.
Yeah. Oh, I know he built the grotto. That does not look like that was built in 1923.
No, no, but it definitely needs work.
Yeah.
It needs at least a whole renovation. I've even heard people talking about tearing it down.
Well, I would like men in hazmat suits going into that thing if I were to buy it. No offense to the half, but, you know, there's been a lot of activity in that grotto. But you can't tear it down. Or could you?
Well, I think that's part of what's a little bit foggy and part of why the value is unclear.
Right.
Most of the agents I've spoke to have said that $200 million is highly unlikely.
Yes.
But the actual value really depends. Can you tear it down? I'm not sure. I don't know if it would have some kind of historic landmarking.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are. This is a very valuable piece of land. It's 5 acres in a great location.
Sure.
The land itself is probably worth, you know, $80 million, maybe $60 million.
What about the zoo animals? What do you do there? He has this one I loved in the story. It said that he had a very rare thing, which is you have a grandfathered zoo permit, private zoo permit, right?
Yeah.
Can't just get one of those.
Nope. So somebody could build a brand new house with a zoo, I guess.
that's what
people want to do in L.A. They don't want, you know, houses that need to be renovated. They want brand new. So, you know, if you can do that here, it's going to affect the value. But I don't know if you would want to tear down the Playboy Mansion. There's so much history there.
Yeah, but of that $200 million, you know, I'm asking you to back of the envelope here. What do you think percentage-wise of that you're buying just reputation and history as opposed to actual product?
Well, who knows what someone's actually going to pay for this?
Sure.
But, I mean, I think a lot of the asking price is the history and the name and the publicity.
Yeah. Do you think they're going to get someone to buy it with all these sort of, you know, caveats in there?
I think it really depends on what the seller is willing to go down to.
Sure.
And it also depends, I think, on the terms of the arrangement with Hef.
Is the seller actually Hef, or is it Playboy Enterprises or whatever it's called?
It's Playboy Enterprises.
Right.
So Playboy bought it in 1971.
Okay.
Hef was the founder of the company back then. I think he
basically
was Playboy.
Right.
Now he's no longer running the company.
Right.
So he actually rents it now from the company. He pays a nominal fee each year to rent it.
The write-off strategies must be spectacular for this home, you know, because theoretically all the entertaining that happens is all write-off, right? I mean, it's just...
Yeah, that's true.
Never been invited. Either of you have ever been invited?
I've never been to the Playboy Mansion.
Not yet.
Yeah.
Now that it's on the market, maybe.
Right? Get there while you can.
An excuse to go now.
Yeah,
you're
you don't want to go there when it's, you know, the Crate and Barrel mansion or something else, someone buys it.
Crate and Barrel mansion. Candace
J. Of the many places that you have written about, you know, this is the sort of barroom question I'm sure you get. What's the craziest? What's the most spectacular?
Well, I think the craziest one is one that's under construction now in Bel Air. It's supposed to come on the market, I think, sometime next year, whenever it's completed, for $500 million, according to the seller. The developer, it's being built speculatively. And it's 100,000 square feet, so that's twice the size of the White House. It has four swimming pools. And my favorite detail is that it has, I think, a 7,000 square foot nightclub that has a casino in it, but also has a VIP room. So there's a VIP room within your own home casino, your own home nightclub. Just has everything. I mean, it's, you know, like 8 or 9 staff bedrooms, I think. It's just an incredible house in an incredible location. It's a very unique lot in Bel Air that kind of is quite private on a hillside. But yeah, that's probably the craziest one. I mean, the ones that I tend to like, that one isn't built yet, so I don't know if it's sort of the most beautiful one, but I've seen a lot of cool architectural homes, you know, just super interesting designs and very amazing locations, but they might not have kind of the, like, wow factor or craziness of something like that.
Has there been one where, you know, you look at it, I mean, that's the most insane, but has there been one that, like, you know, obviously, they're ridiculously priced in almost every case, but, you know, you're like, well, you know, I could actually see myself here. Like, this is sort of me, and this is sort of something I would love to have. Did you experience one of those ski in, ski out places, or was there something comparable to that?
Yeah, there have been. There's many homes I've seen where I'm like, I could see myself. That happens a lot. I mean, but I'm trying to think of one specifically. I don't know. I more sort of tend to gravitate towards the homes that are just doing something really different or out there. I did a story a while ago about Chris Angel's house, the magician, or the illusionist, rather, and he lives in Vegas, and he has, like, a dry cleaning facility in his house, and I don't know, just details like that really kind
of
jump out.
It seems environmentally worrisome to have dry cleaning on the premises.
Yeah, does he have to do it himself, or does he have
staff? No, he has people doing the dry cleaning, but, you know. I don't know. Those types of things kind of stick with me. I've seen some gorgeous houses, but oftentimes in locations that maybe I wouldn't want to live in.
Yeah.
I'm
with Candace T on the staffing issue. Like, you know, I don't know how comfortable I would be. Like, I share a house with a wife and two children. That's enough. You know, I don't really need more beyond that. Now, I know that these are the kinds of things that unless you get to experience what it means, far be it from me to say what I can and cannot do and whether it has any value, but it just, I don't know. This is sort of strange. I want to tell you guys something. Last week, I was in Los Angeles for a journal story that had nothing to do with real estate, but I happened to be at a real estate listing with the subject for this story, and one of the people who was there was this guy, James Harris, who's one of those, I think it's the agency is the name of his real estate agency, and he's part of the whole Bravo $1 million listing reality show. And boy, did he tell me how crazy they were about the journal and its ability to sort of move the needle in terms of buyers. And there's an interest here, is there not, when people are turning to you and giving you information and the scoop, and sometimes you have celebrity homeowners who are willing to talk to you, they're interested in cultivating the journal readership, those people out there who aren't just gawking, who might actually be willing to pay for it. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely. We've had a bunch of homes featured in Mansion that have been sold to people who read about it in Mansion.
Yeah.
Including Rupert Murdoch.
Is that true?
Yeah, that's my favorite example, yeah.
Yowza. So Rupert Murdoch, the chairperson of News Corporation and Fox, 21st Century Fox, he saw a listing in Mansion and was like, that's a nice place, I might want to pick it up?
A couple of times.
Yeah, he saw a story in Private Properties several years back about, I think it was a vineyard in Bel Air, a very unique property, and he ended up buying it.
Huh. And then he did it again a couple recently, like a year ago, it was a townhouse in the West Village that I wrote about in Private Properties, and he bought it. He put it back on the market, but still.
Oh, I didn't know that. He read about that one in Private Properties, too. That's amazing.
The moral of the story is, kids, if we write about your home, Rupert Murdoch might buy it.
Well, I know Mr. Murdoch is an avid listener of the free-for-all. And so if you're listening, Mr. Murdoch, I am happy to take any of those properties off your hands for a reasonable price. And by reasonable, I mean employee discount of 99.9%. That's remarkable. I want to get your assessment of the market overall and whether or not we are existing in a bubble. And, you know, that conversation happens quite a bit. I remember when I was on the market for a home, I used to be like, yeah, let it be a bubble. Let it, like, come down. I can't take these prices anymore. It's crazy. And I reached the conclusion that in New York, I just didn't feel, at least in the area that I was surfing, that, you know, we were ever going to see some sort of price correction. Where do you think we are, Candace T.?
Well, I'm sort of where you used to be.
Okay.
I'm a renter, so yeah. I'm sort of rooting for a bubble so that I can eventually.
Yeah, no, you're actively. You're like, you're here, like the you know, the markets went down. You're like, okay,
right,
fine.
Right.
Yeah.
And I live in Brooklyn, which is like the most overheated market in the entire world.
Yes.
But I mean, Candace Jay is totally right. Even in the real estate downturn in 2008, New York City didn't crash. I think the most we went down was like 30% in some areas, and then it rebounded. I mean, I think our market, I don't think we're going to see a huge reversal anytime soon. I think we could see, you know, a slowdown in the number of sales, maybe fewer bidding wars. That would be nice.
Hasn't that already occurred a tiny bit in that super oligarch category?
End.
Yeah.
Yeah, at the high end. But
like a $100 million place ain't getting the bids it once did.
Right, exactly. They're not flying off the shelves.
Yeah. And I think on the West Coast it might be a little bit different. It's maybe, I don't know, less insulated from bubbles than New York City is. The Bay Area and Los Angeles and other places in Southern California did see a pretty big slowdown during the downturn in certain pockets. So, it's hard to say if it's a bubble, right? But, that's something people talk a lot about in the Bay Area right now with housing.
I was speaking to a friend of mine who bought a home in Miami and, you know, joking with him about how Miami, you know, the projections of it being underwater within, you know, a century or less. I don't mean this at all to sound glib, but does an earthquake, does any sort of like earth moving event sort of factor into anybody's real estate concerns in the Bay Area? They just kind of plow along
Absolutely.
Like nothing's going to happen. They do?
Yeah, I think people know if a huge earthquake comes, that will certainly impact the market in a negative way.
But it hasn't. It doesn't suppress the appetite whatsoever for property, though.
It hasn't so far, no. I mean, it's sort of one of those things that, you know, it's hard to predict when and if it'll happen. I mean, I think they know that it will happen someday, but nobody quite knows when, so it's hard to kind of base any, you know, real estate market valuations on that. But there's a lot of talk about, you know, a tech bubble overheating. That might be a more immediate thing that happens to affect the market out here.
Have either one of you had the opportunity to tour, get a look inside those crazy needle-like properties that are rising in New York by the park that, you know, I don't know exactly.
157?
Yeah, 157. And what's the other one? There's
432 Park Avenue.
Yeah,
there's a bunch. I haven't been in 432 Park. I've been in 157. Great views from up there.
Now, this is like Jason who doesn't know what he's talking about, which is pretty much standard Jason. But, like, I think, like, if I had $100 million to spend or $50 million to spend, I would get too freaked out being up that high. Like, I can't handle, like, just the, you know, you can't open a window, right?
No.
No.
I mean, not if you're on the very, if you're, like, you know.
You're way up there.
Plus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And helicopters are flying below you. Like,
well,
it is so, what is the one that's very, very thin? Is that 157 or is that?
That might be
432 Park, I think, is thinner, right?
432 Park is the very thin one that's, it is so tall. I mean, it is nearly as tall as the Empire State. Isn't it true?
Well, I think to your earlier point, a lot of these buyers aren't planning to live there. You know, a lot of these are being bought by investors.
Right.
I don't know as much about 432 Park because that one's not as far along. But 157, a lot of these are, you know, just people who want to park money somewhere. I don't think they're concerned about opening a window. They just
so they're going to be dark at night because no one's living in them, or maybe they have the clapper and they can have someone come by and just clap the lights.
That's true.
Their staff is living in them.
The staff they have. So even if you're not there, you have staff. That's supposed to be a pretty sweet job. The owner's not there. and you can
right.
stay there. And this
they come once a year, twice a year.
Right. And, you know, the doorman can give you a heads up. So if you have friends over, you just send them down the side freight elevator, right? And you can get them everybody out of the place. I see. I've thought this through completely. This is a good idea.
Sounds like you should apply for that.
Yeah. No, I'm going to sound like my life is much more glamorous than it is because it's not the slightest bit glamorous. But after Los Angeles, I went to Phoenix. I was there for the national championship football game, which was on Monday. But talking to people in the Scottsdale Paradise Valley area, which is sort of, you know, Paradise Valley is sort of like the Beverly Hills of Phoenix, if there is such mm-hmm. a thing. And
which
they
there
were,
isn't.
well, they were saying, you know, there's some crazy homes there, but they were saying they're just getting back to where they were in 06, 07, 08.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my parents live in that area. It's actually kind of soft, the market there right now,
yes.
in the high end.
Yes, and that, you know, it's easy sometimes, I imagine, for people on the outside to look at New York and L.A. and San Francisco and think, oh, wow, we're back and stronger than ever. But that is absolutely not the case in many other sectors of the country, right?
Yeah, in many places, prices still haven't recovered from the downturn. I mean, we're seeing prices well above the downturn in San Francisco and New York and Miami, Los Angeles, but that's not sort of the norm nationwide, I don't think, especially, you know, in the not high-end part of the market. You know, first-time homeowners are struggling. First-time buyers are kind of a much smaller part of the market than they used to be. So that kind of starter home market is struggling in a lot of places.
And a big problem they're having now is inventory on the lower end, because a lot of people can't afford to trade up.
Yeah.
So they don't put their homes on the market.
Yeah.
So then there's just less to choose from if you're yeah. a first-time home buyer.
Yeah, yeah.
And the asking prices are, you know, relatively high because of that. So people, you know, can't afford it.
Do you feel like, you know, in terms of, you know, there's absolutely the potential for a bubble in terms of just price inflation, but the mistakes that were made in the past with people not being able to afford homes, do you think we've put in place some protections from that, or do you think we're getting back there because rates were so low?
Well, I think there's a lot more protections in place
yeah.
than there were before.
And
what
credit
think,
is still not easy to get.
Yeah.
It's still not easy to get a mortgage. And that was, you know, a lot of what we saw, you know, before the no-doc home loans and
right.
everything. We are not having that this time around. So if we do have a bubble, it's coming from a very different place. It's
yeah.
coming from investors buying
yeah.
up these properties. It's not, you know, individuals who can't afford a house getting a loan.
Right.
Because those people aren't getting loans.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, when we're talking about the Playboy Mansion, somebody's like, yeah, I think the bank can give me 85%. Well, can I put 15% down on it? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's not the case here at all.
You see a lot of people buying cash, though, even for these super expensive houses, and then I think they go and get financing afterwards. Nobody wants to tie up that much cash.
Right, right. So it's sort of the move is to say it's an all-cash deal, but then retroactively
right.
go back there and do some financing. Well, guys, I've learned a lot here. It might sound like old hat to you, but it's fascinating, and I appreciate your time. And I'm sure if you're listening, you are a fan of Mansion and the Wall Street Journal, which, let's face it, you guys are keeping the whole newspaper afloat right now. You know, people are obsessed with this section. And so Candace Jackson in San Francisco, Candace Taylor here in New York. If you are in the market for a $250 million home, reach out to them. They can point you in the right direction.
Or if you have one that you'd like to sell.
Oh, yes. If you have one you'd like to, I would like to sell my home for $250 million.
Okay, we'll talk about that off air.
There are chicken fingers in the fridge and a coffee maker. Guys, thank you so much for being here. You're listening to The Free For All. I'm Jason Gay.
WSJ Podcasts. Listen ambitiously.
This episode is brought to you by Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington can affect your portfolio every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab that unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and portfolio. Listen at schwab.com/washingtonwise.